Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. If you care to, for the purposes of this particular podcast, you may call me Rockmeister McCool.
And, here's how it works. You email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Once again, that is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. People ask us questions. People, let us know when we screwed something up. People, just basically we're pretty much open, and, the floor is yours. There's a P.O. box if anyone's interested. Whitney, what is that?
Send us a physical letter, a P.O. box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And we do not like to dilly-dally here because this is your show, and we never get to as many letters as we'd really like. So, Whitney, let's jump right in. What's our first letter?
Here's a letter from Susan.
Hello, hi, Susan. Susan.
Dear Ronnie the Bibbs and Hardcastle McCormick. We were discussing on our last letters episode, Wizard People, Dear Reader, an audio comedy bit by a comedian named Brad Neely, who made a commentary track for the first Harry Potter film, but staged as if it's a book on tape.
Yeah, but, it's really funny.
But he's watching the film, like the events in the book line up with the film, but he's getting a lot of the details wrong.
Like a lot of it wrong, and it's just funny as hell.
Yeah. Dear Ronnie the Bibbs and Hardcastle McCormick, when discussing the new version of Dune, you discussed how in many cases a movie that is a straight-up retelling of a novel devolves into a book report, and that movies need to interpret novels rather than be faithful to a fault. Challenge accepted. What are some of the best or favorite movies that are almost completely faithful to the text? The gold standard is probably Rosemary's Baby, which, as the legend goes, hewed so close to Ira Levin's book because Roman Polanski didn't know how else to adapt a screenplay at the time. Another less problematic version I would give you would be Bang the Drum Slowly, which was written by the author of the original novel, Mark Harris, no relation to the film historian, and is pretty much exactly how the book played out. I look forward to hearing what you come up with. Have a good one, Susan.
That's a great question. And yeah, there are a lot of movie adaptations which are relatively faithful. No movie can be completely faithful because there's always something going to get out. It might just be a little detail or a character doesn't make the cut. But you can be very, very faithful. One of my favorite movie adaptations is incredibly faithful. It's Gillian Armstrong's version of Little Women, which I grew up with as a child. Stars Winona Ryder, Christian Bale, Susan Sarandon, Kirsten Dunst, Samantha Mathis, and many more besides Claire Danes. And it's just a delight. And it helps that that book is exceptionally, it's exceptionally well plotted. It's not like extremely like exciting and full of action, but it's always full of something driving the characters forward. So you really don't need to change anything.
Yeah.
However, this is also an interesting example because the Greta Gerwig version did change things, and I would argue ended up being a better movie as a result because it actually used the text of the film, which is a semi-autobiographical novel based on the real life of Louisa May Alcott and her family. And it added some biographical elements of Louisa May Alcott and made it that much stronger, I think. You get to have the actual adaptation in the movie, but you also get to have this sort of novel, not novel, because that's
novel.
It's not based on novel. This intriguing new interpretation of it as well that is just as satisfying and infinitely more progressive, as progressive today as Little Women was at the time.
Yeah.
But I do think the original Little Women is delightful. And absolutely worth seeing and incredibly faithful to the original text. And that's definitely an example I would use.
A fan has mailed us the novel, which I still haven't read yet, but a really handsome leather-bound novel.
Yeah, it's really nice. Thank you for that.
One of the best film adaptations of one of the best novels would be To Kill a Mockingbird. That one's pretty straightforward in terms of its interpretation. There's not a lot of deviation from the actual source material.
No, it's pretty close. It's very good.
It's not a this might be a little bit hazy, but Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World.
I never read the book.
Yeah, I've read a couple of the past Patrick O'Brien books. Master and Commander was the name of the first book in that series, and The Far Side of the World, I think, was the sixth? I probably have that totally wrong. Look that up, the Patrick O'Brien novels.
Okay, hold on.
But That one gets sort of the raucous spirit of the characters, as well as the slavish detail to maritime warships correctly. The film actually bothered to do that pretty straightforward.
The Far Side of the World is the 10th.
It's the 10th book, okay.
Yeah, Master and Commander was the first, Far Side of the World was the 10th.
The 10th.
Yeah.
I've read I read Master and Commander, I read The Ionian Mission, and I read one other. They're kind of like P.G. Woodhouse. You can never remember which one you read.
Yeah, and there's other ones as well. Sometimes the faithfulness is part of the fault. Mm-hmm. If you've ever seen the movie The Silence of the Lambs, it's very faithful to the book.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's extremely, very, very much what's on the page. Problem is, the stuff that doesn't work about the movie, the really gross attitudes towards trans people, and all of that sort of homophobia that's, like, lined into that movie is in the book as well.
Yeah.
So that's another thing where maybe it would have been nice if that had been... I mean, it was at a different time, and, like, people were, unfortunately, not as cognizant of... I don't want to make excuses for The Silence of the Lambs. There's a lot of things that movie does really, really brilliantly, but there's also a lot of things it has to answer for. And I think if it would be adapted today, it would not handle some of the same material the same way. And it would lift out of it pretty easily, I think. You just wouldn't have to... Anyway. So anyway, that's an example where it's very faithful, it's very celebrated, but to a bit of a fault. But a lot of my favorite adaptations are not that direct. Do you ever actually read the book Trainspotting?
I never read Trainspotting.
Yeah, it's not a linear narrative. It's actually a series of short stories, basically, about all the different characters and side characters in this world, and they just had to pick like 20 of those and left out the other 40. So there's all these incredible stories in Trainspotting that didn't make it into the movie. That's not. Wizard of Oz is very unfaithful.
Yeah, I was going to mention Wizard of Oz. Yeah. The Victor Fleming 1939 feature film.
The one everyone knows.
Yeah, it's not close to the book at all. I've yet to see something that is actually 100% faithful to The Wizard of Oz. Like, just a straight adaptation. I'd love to see an animated version of The Wizard of Oz that looks like the W.W. Denslow illustrations from L. Frank Baum's original printing of it.
Yeah.
Just because I like the way those drawings look. But... that doesn't make me love the movie any less, because I know the book really well. There hasn't been an instance, however, where something's really strayed so far from the source material that I was offended.
I've seen that. If it strays so far from the source material, you wonder why it's even calling itself an adaptation.
Yeah.
That's when you got a problem.
I know that was an issue I had with Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland, where it was a sequel that he made up. So he was playing a little faster and looser with the title, but he was mucking around with Lewis Carroll a lot.
I would actually I thought of a couple of good ones that are faithful adaptations. First one, and I think this one's pretty impeccable, is the Rankin Bass adaptation of The Hobbit.
Okay, yeah.
Every single noteworthy thing from that book is in that movie. And that movie's
almost. There's a few things they take out.
Really minor.
Yeah.
They're really minor.
Like the bear guy.
The bear guy isn't... you don't need the bear guy. Like, we cut out a minor character, but they didn't change anything, is my point. It's all there. And that movie, it just flies by. It's super great. It doesn't feel like anything's missing. It doesn't feel too short. Pay heed. Peter Jackson.
There's a really straightforward version. Joe Wright did a straightforward version of Anna Karenina, which you can tell that they slashed the budget at the last minute because they took some of the bigger, like there's a horse race that they stage as sort of like this cardboard stage play.
They decided, because
a clever way around it.
Their budget got slashed, so the whole movie is taking place like in like a sound stage or like in a stage, and everything has got this kind of fakey kind of quality to it.
It's distracting. I understand why they did it. And they got a few things about the book right. The character of Levin, the one who's sort of like going out and working in his fields, they got him right. I think they cast Vronsky well. I didn't like the Anna in that version.
Yeah.
I think it was Keira Knightley played Anna in that one, didn't she? And that has all the events from the book.
Yeah.
It has all of the story beats.
It's very faithful.
It just goes from beat to beat, and you know what the story of Anna Karenina is, the book,
it's just by the watching style that film. Weird, yeah.
The style is weird, and in hitting the beats and pacing it so quickly, didn't really have the same sort of dramatic power that Tolstoy put into it.
Yeah. Casino Royale is incredibly faithful. The new Casino Royale with Daniel Craig is incredibly faithful to the novel. They added a subplot about Le Chiffre trying to blow up an airplane, which isn't in the book. However, it's kind of just an updated version of a plot point from the book. So it's basically just, we just took this thing from the book and spiced it up a little to give it a little bit more zazz. But it's actually, other than that, it's very, very faithful. Oh, and they changed the game from Baccarat to poker. But other than that, it's very faithful.
More people know poker now. Oh, you know what? One adaptation that really did actually kind of piss me off was that recent live-action version of Peter Rabbit.
Oh, yeah. Because
I grew up reading Beatrix Potter, so, you know, that kind of, like, placid garden setting was sort of replaced with this kind of slapstick adventure where Domhnall Gleeson is screaming at CGI rabbits, and Domhnall Gleeson is just great in that movie because he's selling it. You know, in that moment, he is furious at an anthropomorphic rabbit, but the rabbits themselves suck. And there's a non-diegetic cover of Len's "Steal My Sunshine" sung by CGI sparrows.
Oh,
like they actually sing it.
It's a good song.
I've just heard it at every gas station I've stopped at in the last 20 years.
It's a sparrow book number. Every once in a while, you'll just walk outside and hear the sparrows belting that shit. You know?
It's still my sunshine.
Hi, sparrows! Let's move on. That's a great question. Thank you so much.
Here's a letter from J-Lo. Hello, J-Lo. Dear Bibbs, and oh gosh, it's like four lines of binary. Pronounced Rockmeister McCool. I ran that through an ASCII to binary converter.
Yes!
So that's Rockmeister McCool in binary. And I'm not going to read all the ones and zeros.
Ah, that's tempting. All right.
I feel like you... this is a Star Trek letter. I feel like you brushed past the lesson of 11001001, which is an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Real fast, one of our podcasts on our Patreon is called All Our Yesterdays, and we're reviewing every single episode of Star Trek in production order. And we just tackled a Next Generation episode with the binary title, which was about the Enterprise going through repairs from a species called the Binars, which are a binary species. There's two of them. But there was a lot of weird ethical questions raised about the holodeck in that episode. And in particular, that we singled out that there's this sort of weird vibe of Picard and Riker sort of leering and being weird as they look at a holographic projection of a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And it just comes off as a weird vibe.
Yeah.
But let's hear this letter, because I'm curious what they have to say about it.
I lost the letter.
Oh, no.
A little bit.
I am vamping. If you steal my sunshine.
Okay, here we go.
Okay.
I feel like you brushed past the lesson, which Bibbs commenting on what the Binars should have done while forgetting that Picard asked the same question during the episode. A quick refresher. A biocomputer race boards the Enterprise under the guise of fixing the holodeck. Once aboard, the Binars fake a crisis, clearing everyone off except for Picard and Riker. It's revealed that their planet's computer, that the Binars rely on for life, was threatened by an electromagnetic pulse and needed to be backed up on the Enterprise for survival of their race. Now, both Picard and the episode and Bibbs in the podcast ask why the Binars simply didn't ask for help, with them responding they couldn't have risked them saying no. The purpose of the Binars to this new Trekkies interpretation was not about their reliance on technology, but their black-and-white, all-or-nothing thought process. There are only two outcomes. Yes, Starfleet agrees and saves the planet, or no, and they die of natural disaster.
Yeah.
While they seem like a highly evolved species, they've in fact regressed into being unable to consider more than two outcomes for any situation. Binars.
Yeah.
While their decision to steal the Enterprise for their safety is logical, to a human, dynamic thought process seems ridiculous. You also failed to mention what happens to the Binars. They freely turn themselves over to the authorities and are escorted off the ship to face trial. What struck me was Picard's seeming lack of compassion in that moment. They could have added a line of Picard saying he'd try to help them avoid punishment or get off with a lighter sentence, whether this is to show a more lawful aspect of Picard's alignment or just a more just legal system in the future, I am unsure.
Mm.
Also, binary, 11001001, translates into decimal, our everyday counting system, as 201.
Okay.
Nothing too crazy there. ASCII 201 is the capital E with an accent, which...
Yeah, we tried to translate the title of the episode.
Mentioned in the previous episode.
We tried to translate the title of the episode. It turns out there are multiple binary languages, yeah. which I was unaware of. So, yeah, there's a couple of different interpretations of that.
Now that I'm watching along, it's become my most anticipated show.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you. Boolean end of letter equals true if end of letter sincerely J-Lo. No, not that one.
Thank you so much. That is an excellent point. Mm. That is we I thought I had talked about the fact that because at the end of the episode, Picard does ask the Bynars, why didn't you just ask us? And Picard probably would have done it. It's in character. There's no particular reason why they couldn't have done that. It would have been in the Federation's best interest because they clearly have friendly relations with this planet. It does make sense. And I was sort of struggling with this, and I kind of wish the episode had put a bit of a button on that, but that is an excellent point. They're a binary species. They see everything in yes or no.
Mm.
And they couldn't risk a no. And they couldn't understand the possibility of any sort of nuance. Mm. So that's an excellent point. I actually really like that a lot, and it makes the episode a little better.
Yeah, you know? They think in binary. It was yes or no for them.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you for that. That's really insightful, and I appreciate the email.
Here is another Star Trek letter. Okay. This comes from Ensign Gerbrandt. greetings, Captain Seibel and Commander Bibiani.
Oh!
I like that I outrank you in this letter.
Of course you do.
Salutations from the USS Music Store where I work on the lower decks.
Nice.
I listen to your log entries while puttering around the shipping dock.
Please keep this metaphor going.
I watch the episodes from the historical tapes from the Prophet Roddenberry in anticipation of reviewing your logs, and I always have comments and thoughts. I have held off writing until now because I had a very strange headcanon moment that I wanted to share. I love headcanon.
Headcanons are fun. If you don't know what we're talking about, it's when you come up with a theory about how a story works, but it's not confirmed in the show.
Yeah.
It makes sense, but there's no actual confirmation in the show that it's real. So that's
it's like we were talking in our last Star Trek episode about how the character Counselor Troi, we haven't seen her office.
Yeah.
So we like to think in our head canon that maybe she has a really nice office somewhere on the show.
Yeah, and she's actually being a counselor to people on the ship because that is what she should be doing at least some of the time.
And just to pause for a minute, this is one of the things I like about Star Trek. I think it encourages headcanon.
Yeah.
It's a vivid enough TV show that your mind begins to wander into, like, the larger universe.
Yeah, and you start asking questions about what else is going on here. And usually things are put together with enough logic, internal logic, that it makes sense. Yeah, and you don't run into just this problem where, oh, that couldn't possibly exist because of this. And then you realize that,
makes sense. And even the bad Star Trek shows have been pretty good about sort of expanding the world that we live in, sometimes in really stupid ways with a lot of the more recent shows.
Yeah.
And one of the frustrating things about watching Star Wars is they haven't been doing that. It's like, we're going to make a brand new film. It's Rogue One. Well, we know that shit. You're not going to a new world.
To be fair, there's a lot of ancillary material you're not looking at.
Well, there's a lot of
They're doing a better job of that than I think.
Yeah, I haven't been watching the TV shows, so
yeah, I'm not even the biggest fan, but they have been doing the work.
All right. I just completed your entry on 11001001, and I had two comments. First of all, to display my credibility as a fellow Trekkie and a title I wear with pride, during the episode where Picard and Riker are deciding where to beam onto the bridge, I found myself yelling at the view screen, just beam one into the conference room and one into the captain's ready room.
Oh, that would have been
clever.
I have
submitted a picture from an online technical manual for reference. Essentially, the doors to those rooms are on opposite sides of the bridge. There are tools that allow them to open the doors in emergency situations if they're locked. Just a thought, and my Trekness decided to rage for a moment. And yes, here's a little schematic of the bridge of the Enterprise.
No, that tracks. That tracks. That's actually quite clever, yeah.
Yeah, In the opening shot of the theme song, you can see, like, the back of the observation deck. And if you look closely, you can see people walking around in there.
Yeah, it's
a cool little special effect.
But, like, in the episode, if you didn't hear or didn't... If you don't remember the episode or you didn't listen to our podcast about it, there's a bit where the Bynars have locked themselves onto the bridge of the Enterprise. Mm. And in order to retake the Enterprise, Picard and Riker, who are the only two crew members left on the ship, they decide to beam onto the bridge. However, if they beam too close together and if the Bynars are violent... They could just be immediately shot, so they decided to beam on different parts of the bridge. But it turns out there was a cleverer way to do that. And you're not wrong. Yeah.
And yes, there's a toilet on the bridge.
Thank you. Yeah. There I'm is. Glad. It's a question we've often asked.
It's there. It's all the blueprints. Now into the ridiculous headcanon moment. The holodeck, it uses energy in order to create real items for users to interact with. We have established that much like the replication technology, it can make things like water or something it can carry out into the real world.
Right.
So what if the opposite was possible? Can you put some matter, any old matter will do, into the holodeck, and could it convert it into energy to be stored and used later, like we see with replicators doing with leftovers? Mm-hmm. Now, what if Riker did use the holodeck for a more lascivious act and wanted to dispose of his genetic material in a way that would remove suspicion of misappropriated use of Starfleet technology? Couldn't the holodeck turn anything... Well, like, if you have to use the bathroom on the holodeck, what do you do then? Could the holodeck turn anything you leave behind into energy, and Riker could go off and be ready for his next away mission? Does Quark's power Deep Space Nine? Oh, God, I don't want to think about it.
Oh, God. I actually do think I have an answer for this, but I'll let that
anyway, as always, greatly appreciate all the work you gentlemen do, and I completely understand if you like not to read this email in public.
No.
Too late. I just hope you gentlemen get a chuckle out of my strange brain and where it goes sometimes. Sincerely yours, Ensign Gerbrand.
Look, we ask similar questions all the time. It's fine. And Star Trek invites these questions because they want you to take it seriously. Mm. And that was a big part of our talk about this episode was the sort of practical and ethical ramifications of the holodeck.
Mm.
It is my understanding that because the holodeck uses replicator technology and transporter technology, they should be able to do this. I will cite an episode from Deep Space Nine. You can probably remember the title better than I can. There's an episode of Deep Space Nine where many members of the crew are in a transporter accident, and in order to keep all of their... Because it takes a lot of memory to keep a person's entire DNA sequence, every single little detail about their body and all their memories and their soul, like to actually like keep all of that in a computer takes up a lot of space. And they've lost so many people in this transporter room accident that the computer on Deep Space Nine can't handle it all. Mm. And it shunts the people who are trapped in the transporter.
The patterns. Yeah.
It shunts them into the holodeck. So they're in the holodeck, but if they die in the holodeck, they will die for real. And they're in the middle of, like, an action-adventure storyline a la James Bond.
Like, if they're, that character doesn't survive the story, then their data will be deleted.
Yeah. So, yes, it is my understanding that they absolutely can delete genetic material or... So I think that's a thing. I think that's the thing. And it's another thing where the holodeck is a really fascinating idea for a sci-fi story of any kind. And Star Trek gets a lot of mileage out of it. There are a lot of ethical ramifications that they do not touch at all. And I think this is one of them. It's deadly in there. It could be very easily.
As for the idea of using the technology to turn something from matter back into energy, they also do that on... we actually get to see that on camera for the first time in an episode of Voyager, where... I think Janeway replicates a book as a gift, and they don't want it, so she puts it like back on this little platform and it dissipates again.
Yeah, that's been done.
So you can replicate things, you can de-replicate them. I imagine it's not like a one-to-one ratio, you can't just do that infinitely.
I feel
but
like there's a...
Because it takes energy to make the thing.
One of my favorite underwritten storylines in Star Trek was in season one of Voyager, where they had a serial killer on the ship, played by Brad Dourif.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's an awesome idea. And, of course, they killed him right away, like, beginning of season two. Mm. Such a waste. But it raises the question of, that would have been a cool way to kill someone on a starship. Mm. Just to, like, shove their head in a replicator. Have the replicator just, like,
just dissipate
beam
their
up
brain.
Parts of their brain. Like, that would be fucked up.
There's probably safety protocols, so it's not like...
holodeck doesn't seem to have any.
When you replicate food, it comes on a plate. It replicates the plate as well. You're not going to eat the plate, so you... Or maybe it's made of food, I don't know. But you eat it, you put the plate back on the replicator. Yeah. What if you put the plate on there and you leave your hand on the platform? It's not going to dissipate your hand. It's probably going to have a little red light saying, I can't do that.
Have we ever seen it happen? My point is that
it seems like a logical design
A lot of things seem logical, and Star Trek does them anyway. Like, it would seem logical for the holodeck not to create an evil artificial intelligence just because Data wants to be challenged in a mystery. You'd think that wouldn't be something a holodeck could do, but it turns out, yeah, they could totally do that.
You would think if it happens once, they'd immediately put safety protocols into place so they don't accidentally create life every day.
Well, you'd think they would do that anyway. You wouldn't want the you wouldn't want artificial intelligence created in the holodeck because it creates an ethical problem. And yet, that was apparently not something they thought of.
Do you remember
for a while?
Do you remember what happened with Moriarty?
I do.
The
actually.
Hologram, yeah,
I do.
Because he came back in a second episode, and they dealt with him.
They dealt. I think they. I think it's. If memory serves, I should like that episode. But anyway.
This is why we have a Star Trek podcast, so we can ramble about Star Trek technology. So thanks for joining us on the Letters episode, where we do it more.
And if you're not a member of our Patreon, we've got over 100 episodes of backlog on our Star Trek. And if you sign up, you get all of them right away. That's like a lot. That's like a lot. Most of them are like 40 minutes to an hour long.
Right. So we're already like 16 episodes into Next Generation at this point, which is like super tech heavy. So we're having a lot of discussions like this on our Next Generation podcast. Here's another letter, and it's not about Star Trek.
All right. We'll find a way to make it about Star Trek.
It's from RJ. Dear Bibbs and Whitney, yesterday marked the end of the London Film Festival. I got to attend for a few days and saw it last night in Soho, Titan, and The French Dispatch at press screenings.
Oh, cool.
My first ever.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And the closing film of the festival was Joel Coen's The Tragedy of Macbeth.
Oh, I'm jealous. I haven't seen that yet.
I haven't seen that yet either. Naturally, the response was overwhelmingly positive, but there was a tweet from someone I follow that got me thinking, and I wanted to gauge your perspectives on it, particularly Whitney. She was expressing frustration about people who wrote off the film, saying they didn't get it, advising that you can't give a film a fair rating without engaging with the text. She studied Shakespeare a lot, and therefore felt quite strongly on the film itself, and had clarified, since her frustration was more with blanket statements about not getting it rather than people having opinions on the film without reading the play, but it got me thinking, and I really wanted your take on this. Whitney, you've often said that an adaptation of something, be it a TV show, book, should be able to stand up on its own legs without depending on the source material. This goes back to the letter from earlier.
Sure.
I also know that both of you have read a fair amount of Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Do you then believe the same, that a Shakespeare film should work by itself without needing to read the text, or do you think his work is far too deep or layered to go in blind? Personally speaking, I have no dog in this race. I studied Shakespeare briefly at school and really didn't care about it back then. And it's not a subject that I've ever felt compelled to circle back to, though I do think this will potentially damage my enjoyment of films based on his work, particularly this new film, which I will end up seeing as part of the Oscars, I'm sure. We'd love to hear what you guys think. Also, William, if you ever apologize on Twitter again for releasing only 5 podcasts in a week, I will fly to California and force you to give yourself a break.
Okay, fine.
I know it feels like you don't do enough, but Jesus Christ, you do. We're all very grateful. Sincerely yours, RJ. Yeah,
Thank you.
I went out of town for 4 days, and you said, I apologize, Whitney's out of town for 4 days. We only have 5 podcasts in the hopper. In 4 days.
Well, look, I'm a bit of a workaholic, and sometimes I feel like, you know, we may have bit off more than we can consistently chew, and it bothers me that we can't always release things on the schedule that we want to.
Yeah.
It bothers me. We would like to have Cancel Too Soon be every single week rather than sometimes every other week, which is what we have to do lately. And that pisses me off. And it bothers me that, you know, sometimes we like to have a schedule of like a new Patreon episode about Star Trek is every Tuesday. It bothers me when we have to release it on a Wednesday or a Thursday.
Yeah,
it bothers me, and sometimes we fall behind on other things.
If we hadn't other things in our lives, if we were just doing this podcast, then if we were like post-college guys who were single and just sort of doing the thing that post-college guys do, we could probably do that much.
Yeah.
But
we're not. We're middle-aged.
We're older men now.
Yeah,
we have other things in our lives.
Families and stuff.
Which makes you a more complete human being. But
true, and I'm not. Yeah. I don't regret that at all, but sometimes it does make the job a little harder than I'd like, and that's annoying.
But to the bard.
Yes. Thank you, by the way, for the kind thoughts, by the way. It's nice of you to sort of let me off the hook there, but yeah.
Shakespeare is, he's one of those authors that sort of leaked into the subconscious of sort of civilization. So a lot of the stories and the characters and the concepts in Shakespeare are just going to kind of come with us.
Yeah.
So
Romeo and Juliet as a concept is very, very familiar, even if you've never read or seen the play.
Yeah. And beyond that, even though Shakespeare borrowed most of his stories from other sources, borrowed is a polite word for steal.
Yeah. It's his versions that we know.
It's his versions we know, and you kind of... you don't even necessarily have to know the stories to understand what's going on in Shakespeare. Yeah. The language is, can be a bit dense at times.
I would argue that in terms of, but, the, if you're being faithful to the language, no matter how much you try to be accessible to a mainstream audience, there's bound to be something in the language that only people who really study Shakespeare are going to fully appreciate, because it references something very contemporary to when it was written, or maybe it's a literary allusion that no longer works anymore, or it's an esoteric definition of a word. And as a result, people who know more about Shakespeare are always going to have at least a bit of a leg up on a faithful Shakespeare adaptation, at least with to the text, than people who don't. I think that's sort of inescapable. However, I argue, and I know this is a winning question, but I would argue that every Shakespeare play would be better off seen first than read, because it's, his plays are very well plotted for the most part. They're very exciting, and you can absolutely follow along with what's happening without understanding every single little detail and nuance.
If it's staged,
And you can, and once you understand the greater context of everything that's happening, it might intrigue you more and get you more interested in reading the text and understanding the text in greater depth.
And I think a lot of people are very threatened by Shakespeare when really he's far more accessible than he often gets credit for.
When you were in middle school or high school.
I started getting into Shakespeare around age 12.
Was the first time Shakespeare was assigned in a class? Like what grade would that be?
Seventh grade.
Yeah. When your teacher said, we're about to read, I don't know, Othello, Hamlet, whatever you read.
It was Romeo and Juliet.
Did you get people in your class going, oh.
Yeah.
I had that too. There's this sort of like, oh no, here it comes.
Meanwhile,
I was dreading
My dad would take me to bookshops often, and because he wanted to encourage me to read, he would just buy me books. It was really kind of him. And one day I said, hey, can I get this Complete Works of Shakespeare? It's big and thick, and I like it. and it's on sale. It's like $8. And he's like, oh, yes, I'll get you the Complete Works of Shakespeare, son. And I started to read The Tempest, and I'm 12 years old. I'm not really getting the temp. It's like, there's a monster in it, and Prospero is really mean. Like, that's all I'm really taking from it. But I was really loving the language of it, sort of the weird poetry.
I wish I'd had... My parents were cool about that, but there's always that one shitty memory when you were a kid of someone discouraging you, and it sticks with you. I remember when I was in elementary school, and we went to... You know, the whole class went to a library. It was like a library close to the school, and we would walk to it. And everyone would get a book, and we'd have to do a book report on it. And I wanted to read David Copperfield.
Okay.
And the teacher and the rest of the class kind of laughed at me because it was really long and dense, and there's no way you can do it.
Yeah.
And so I didn't read David Copperfield, and I still haven't read David Copperfield. And it actually hurt me. So let me explain something just to everybody. even if a child wants to read something that seems like it's above their reading level, let them try.
Yeah.
Let them try, for God's sake.
Well, and that holds true into adulthood as well.
Yeah.
Don't go into a Shakespeare thinking that it is going to be dense and difficult. If you look at the Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow speech from Macbeth, there's no weird words in that.
Yeah.
Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. That's not difficult to understand.
No, it's a little flowery, but it's pretty straightforward. Yeah.
All our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. You know,
all our yesterdays. Comes up again. We made it about Star Trek!
That's where the Star Trek episode comes from. That speech. That was total coincidence, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't trying to tie it into Star Trek. How familiar do you need to be with Shakespeare to Star Trek? Shakespeare in the original Klingon. How familiar do you need to be with Shakespeare in order to go into a Shakespeare adaptation? You have it already.
Yeah.
You know already, I think. And
if it's a good adaptation, you don't need it.
Yeah.
If it's a good adaptation, they'll make it exciting even if it's your first Shakespeare thing.
Yeah. And sometimes having a deep familiarity with the play can harm an adaptation.
It makes it, you can have this sort of rigid idea of how it's supposed to be.
I saw Joss Whedon's version of Much Ado About Nothing. It's like, come on, man. There's so much more in this text that you're not dealing with. And I'm getting frustrated even though he's telling the story reasonably well. Yeah. Or that really completely rotten version of Macbeth with Michael Fassbender. It's like, which cuts out like 90% of the text and just focuses on these weird visuals.
Yeah. And it's just one tone the entire way.
Yeah, and it's just like this funereal thing in a red cloud.
It's this incredibly oversimplified version of Macbeth. I find that movie very frustrating.
But, you know, a lot of people did like that version because they liked the visuals and they could follow the story and they were getting told the emotions of the play through just visuals and not dialogue.
Mm.
You know, being a Shakespeare dork, I wanted more of the dialogue. I liked to hear that poetry, and so that they didn't have it kind of frustrated me. So it's a two-edged sword.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is.
And I think, if you see a really good adaptation, they're going to be telling the story and communicating the emotions incredibly well. If you know the text, you're going to be noticing a lot more of the nuances and how they are interpreting that
text. I'm noticing this a lot, this sort of generalized trepidation to watch an adaptation of something without being familiar with the original. I was talking to someone on Twitter and they were debating whether they really liked, we didn't, but who cares? They really liked Denis Villeneuve's first Dune movie. And they were like, "Oh, I want to find out what happens next. Should I watch the David Lynch version?" Is what they were asking.
Uh-huh.
And the answer to that question is, if you want to, basically, it's like, "Oh, will it spoil the movies?" Well, you'll know what happens, but it's just like a 60-year-old book at this point. You can also look it up on Wikipedia if you wanted
to
know.
Go to your library and check it out.
I feel like we're like, "Oh, I don't want to see it the wrong way, or I don't want to get the wrong interpretation." My advice to everyone is dive in. Just whatever you're interested in, dive in. If you don't know where to start, you can ask someone. If you can't find someone, dive in. Just jump into it. Give it a try. If it doesn't seem right the first time or you're not getting it, try something else in that canon or in that world or whatever. But just, there's no set specific way to dive into a lot of the stuff in the universe. There really isn't.
You just open the book and start reading.
Open the damn book. You want to know what happens to the rest of Dune? All the books are right there. You can read it right now. And if you liked the movie before, and if the movie is any good, imagine there's two possibilities. You're going to see the movie, get excited, read the books, and then find out that you don't like the adaptation. Well, good news. Now you have the better version of the books.
Mm.
It's not like, I've ruined the movies. Well, no, the movies might have ruined themselves. That's not really the problem here. You know, it's not like need the movies if you have the books at that point. So just jump in.
No,
maybe you like it, maybe you won't, but try it.
We've made the mistake of thinking that a film is going to be the ultimate definition of what a literary work is. When the literary work has been around for a lot longer in most cases. The movie always follows the book anyway.
Yeah. Sometimes the movie becomes more popular than the work. Case in point, Wizard of Oz.
Where people
know how the Wizard of Oz movie turns out than how the actual book does nowadays.
And the popular view of certain works of literature are typically of the movie. That's
the image that we have. Think about how many people, when they think of Frankenstein, think of Boris Karloff.
Yeah.
That's very specifically designed for that movie. That's not actually accurate to the book.
Right. In the book, he was like a pale, lanky, long, dark hair and just looked dead.
Didn't have the bolts in his neck or anything like that. None of that. That's all James Whale. Yeah.
So, same with Dracula. Yeah,
exactly. Those are images of those characters.
We get the images from the movies, but the books have been around for a lot longer, and there's no reason not to just sort of go to the library and crack it open.
Yeah.
I read an article once. I was toying with buying James Joyce's Ulysses for a long time, and I didn't know how do I read the Ulysses? It's big and dense.
Start at page 56.
I was like, is there some secret? Is there something I need to do to prime myself? And I did read one article that says, with Ulysses, you just need to read it. You just need to start and go through. Don't stop for interpretation. Let it wash over you. That's a good approach to anything I've found. There's some things that do require some study. If you're really intrigued, you can stop and get annotations, but for the most part, just start reading, and you'll get it. It'll get under your skin, or it won't, but that's the important thing.
Awesome.
Here's a letter from Jeremy. Hello, Jeremy.
Hi, Jeremy.
Dear Bibbs and Rockmeister, I'm writing from Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
Nice.
Where our cinematic acclaim to fame is Cool Runnings was shot here.
Hey, that's a great movie. Whitney finally saw that not that long ago.
I finally got to see Cool Runnings. Yeah, it was totally sweet, kind of generic, but good sports movie.
Very likable film.
First of all, I love your podcast. I think they keep up the spirit of really insightful film criticism alive. Oh, well, thank you. We try. Keep up the good work. Now onto my question. There always seems to be some ongoing discourse concerning how filmmaking is a young person's game. Most directors finish their careers with subpar films that are below their normal standards. I often wonder how valid this criticism is. Looking back at the careers of some of my favorite directors, I would say a lot of their later films were some of the most interesting and assured pieces they've made. I would even go so far as to say a lot of directors' final films, such as Altman's A Prairie Home Companion, Lubitsch's Clooney Brown, Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in America, and Yasujiro Ozu's An Autumn Afternoon, could stand among their best work. I even think so-called lesser films like Hitchcock's Family Plot and Billy Wilder's Buddy Buddy have their moments and are worth discussing.
I quite love Family Plot, actually.
I haven't seen Buddy Buddy. I know there are exceptions to the rule, but I think it's important to note that some directors simply struggle by not having the resources or the clout once granted to them in their younger years. Part of the problem might come down to ageism. Once you grow older, your opinions no longer matter, and you're pegged as old-fashioned. However, I do not believe being older makes you automatically out of touch or passé. Spielberg, Ridley Scott, and Scorsese, for example, are all in their 70s and make some very interesting films. I think Spielberg is getting more interesting as he gets older, frankly.
In many respects, yes.
Yeah.
Scorsese, too, honestly.
Yeah, Scorsese, like, he's just, I'm going to do whatever. Anyways, just wondering what your what were your thoughts on this topic? Does this argument hold any water? Should directors be put out to pasture once they have peaked? What are some of your favorite final films from great directors? Thanks, and keep up the great work. Regards from Canada, Jeremy.
Yeah, there's this idea, I've heard, and I know you work for him, and I maybe can't comment on this, but Quentin Tarantino has argued that he wants to, like, retire relatively young because he's seen other filmmakers just keep going and their later films aren't as interesting. That's a philosophy I've heard a lot of people espouse. In my younger years, maybe I've even espoused it myself. If I was very immature. I think that there's a factor of that, which is the shittiness of the industry. This sort of you used to be big, what have you done for me lately? And it's harder for talented filmmakers to get decent projects, or even if they can, to get decent budgets or decent casts for those projects. And sometimes their later films are just struggling even to get off the ground. Yeah, and that can just be rough in itself.
There's a whole generation of genre filmmakers that you and I grew up watching that don't seem to make movies so much anymore as they get older. People like Joe Dante and John Carpenter. John Carpenter doesn't care anymore.
Yeah, but, John Carpenter retired about 10 years ago from directing anyway. But like, Joe Dante has been struggling to make movies for about 20 years now.
Yeah, but John Carpenter as well. What was his last film? The Ward? That wasn't a big one.
No, that was like 10 years ago now. It was good. I actually like that movie. It's a little predictable, but it's very well made. And Joe Dante, the last couple, I didn't see like the last film he did, but the last film I think before it, The Hole, is a really, really great horror movie for kids. Like a great slumber party horror movie. Like really well made in every way. They haven't lost it. Their opportunities have dried up a little bit. So that's a factor. Another factor that I've noticed is there's this attitude towards filmmakers who have a long career that if they keep following the same sort of idea or notion, people get a little tired of it. Like, I've noticed people say, like, oh, Terrence Malick has just been making the same movie over and over again since The Thin Red Line. And to an extent, yeah, he's been telling stories in similar styles.
Similar themes.
Yeah. But this is the kind of thing that when they're dead, we celebrate. We say, like, oh, look at this fantastic body of work. Yeah, not everything is equally good. I think Nine of Cups sucks. But, like, these are movies that are about big ideas, and he tried to explore it from multiple angles and tried to sort of refine a new cinematic language. And how lucky are we that Terrence Malick was able to create this really fascinating body of work? And when you watch them all together, you get this wonderful sense of his being. But if you're only looking at it one at a time, you say to yourself, oh, To the Wonder is a little bit like Tree of Life, so let's disregard that. That's not fair. The other thing I notice is that sometimes when filmmakers
A movie like the Tree of Life.
Oh, what a tragedy, right? Like, oh no. This was a problem that people had. Like, a lot of people wrote off Casino when it came out in the 90s because it was like two films after Goodfellas, and it was kind of similar in some respects to Goodfellas. They have some similarities. They're very different films. And I gotta tell you something, I think Goodfellas is still arguably the better film. If I was given an opportunity to watch one or the other, I'd probably watch Casino again. Casino is electric. Casino's fantastic.
Yeah.
But the other thing I think is that sometimes when, especially filmmakers are allowed to get old, like, you know, they're actually still allowed to work, like, into their twilight years, and they don't, like, retire when they're 60, they're, like, working when they're 70 or 80, they often gravitate towards films that are interesting to people who are older. And as a result, young people who are too often considered like the primary arbiters of taste, not that their opinions are invalid, but like they're just experiencing one part of life. People in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s might respond to these movies differently than people in their 20s do.
Right.
And as a result, these movies are sometimes disregarded until people get older and start approaching them from the perspective of more mature people.
What I find really curious is senior citizens are a huge part of box office.
Yes, they are.
And films about and for an older audience tend to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Something like The Most Exotic Marigold Hotel. That's a hit movie.
Best Exotic,
Best Exotic.
I like that movie. That's a very sweet film.
But everybody refers to that, they dismiss it. Oh, that's a grandpa movie. And because so much of the film market is geared toward a young audience, the studios believe that they can only hire young directors who cater directly to a young audience. So an older director making a film with an older audience in mind, or at least concepts that would be grasped more easily by an older audience, are dismissed by a lot of not just audiences, but also critics who aren't as old. Who don't have that perspective. And I think that's an incredibly valuable perspective. You know old people in your life. Yes, you do. And they're going to this, getting sort of their stories and their perspective is incredibly important.
I worry.
It's because you're going to be learning about yourself eventually.
Yeah, I worry that, again, there's always, ever since especially like the mid-20th century, when advertising started keying into youth, not only as a demographic, but as some kind of ideal.
Yeah.
We started devaluing age and wisdom and made it more about, even if you're old, what you really want to be is young, right? Well, not necessarily. There's a lot to be said about being old. There's a lot to be said about, learning more about yourself and understanding more about the world and your place in it and being comfortable with that rather than having this, need to go, go, go all the time. These are different vibes and they're very, very much valid. But I feel like there's a problem we're going to run into in this industry where we spend so much time catering to this demographic, this perceived demographic of like people in their teens and 20s and maybe early 30s, and making movies for them, movies about things that young people can appreciate even if you don't have a lot of worldly experience, things like superheroes. I'm not decrying the genre, it's a perfectly good genre, but it tends to skew a younger demographic is my point. And there's always an influx of people coming into that demographic. People are always being born, growing up, whatever. And that's one of the reasons why critics often have to sort of reiterate things. Because, there's a whole new generation now that's only just getting into things.
Yeah, I wrote about this. But yeah, you wrote about it 8 years ago. Do it again.
Exactly. Here's the thing we don't talk about as much, though. The people who are in their 20s 20 years ago are now in their 40s. And only getting older. And we created a system that caters to them, where they're engaged in the media maybe more so than other generations have been, and still really interested in movies and stuff. And yeah, I'm sure they still like a lot of the old movies, the superhero movies, action movies, horror movies, whatever, but they're also human beings who are having more human experience, and they're probably interested in movies that they didn't used to be interested in because they speak to them more profoundly. We are not creating a media system that speaks to that. We are just perpetuating the media systems that focus on movies for people in their 20s. And we're not creating a system like all of these like YouTube video channels and everything that are all about stuff that people in their 20s like are fine. But I guarantee you there's a big market for people who are in their 40s and 50s now, who've grown up with all those movies, who are also interested in more what we would consider art house cinema. Or at the very least more quote-unquote serious cinema that talk about more mature issues.
What kind of frustrates me, my wife listens to a podcast called This Had Oscar Buzz.
Oh, that's a great podcast.
And it talks about sort of prestige pictures that studios put out at the end of the year that people were talking about in award season, but ultimately didn't get a lot of award nominations. And those are all pretty ambitious films with a lot of adult themes. Those are grown-up movies, and they're all quite good because they're dealing with some complex adult things, or at least trying in an earnest kind of way. And yet, at least the circles I run in, we aren't canonizing those types of movies. These sorts of films, like, to pick one randomly, like, how about The Soloist?
Movie, really? The Soloist?
Well, I don't know. Or Snow Falling on Cedars, whatever you got.
Something that's just sort of well-intentioned.
A little bit quieter, well-intentioned, more mature. Yeah, okay. Those two are like kind of mediocre films, but I've seen just as mediocre or even worse movies get brazenly canonized and given these 4K digital Blu-ray releases for collectors because they appeal to sort of a teenage sensibility.
Yeah.
A lot of, like, really awful slasher movies get really, really Tiffany releases on home video.
That's another one where I would argue that that's a matter of sort of adjusting expectations. What a slasher movie is trying to achieve is maybe a little bit easier to achieve than something who's trying to be profound.
I suppose so, but...
So therefore, it's a great slasher. And being a great slasher might arguably be easier than being a great, profound work of human, intimate drama.
Yeah. it's frustrating, though, that the men of my generation have chosen to... What they've chosen to canonize.
Yeah.
And what, you know, when... And I've talked about this before. The kind of... The great films of the 1980s. You ask a white guy my age is going to say Ghostbusters and Back to the Future. And those are fine films.
Those are very good movies.
But they're not talking about Chariots of Fire or Out of Africa or, you know, Fitzcarraldo or you know, other films of the 1980s.
My Left Foot.
Yeah, films of the 1980s that actually are dealing... That were for a grown-up audience.
Yeah.
L'Argent is one of the best films of the 1980s. Yeah. Who brings that up? Besides me.
That's
a Robert Bresson film.
Not as many as you might think.
But how many people are talking about Ghostbusters still? Everybody's still talking about freaking Ghostbusters.
You can't fucking escape it, can you?
It's like Ghostbusters is overexposed at this point. I don't even want to sit and watch the original Ghostbusters anymore. If it's a good film, but...
I love that movie. We've seen it many times.
Kind of sick of it now.
Yeah.
And this idea that we're constantly catering to what we loved when we were young or something that could be enjoyed when we were young is a big part of this conversation. Yeah. And sort of the way those things can be easily marketed and redistributed and remade because they're the kinds of limited stories that can be sequelized very easily.
There's a line, I think I'm paraphrasing, that Alonzo Duralde, the co-host of Linoleum Knife and the head critic for The Wrap, has said on multiple occasions, which is it really a good movie or did you just see it when you were seven?
Yeah.
You know, I know I'm getting the line slightly wrong, but it's a good point regardless. We got a little into the weeds there, but that's a great question. Let's move on. I think we got time for one or two more.
Here's a letter from Eric. Hello, Eric. Gentlemen, I have a critique because as a wise man once said, everyone's a critic. Well, more of a suggestion. I noticed in your Patreon episodes, you do the standard introduction of yourselves and of your bona fides at the start, and then the Patreon thank you at the end. It occurs to me, since the audience is already paying for the show and therefore familiar with who you are, it might be less important to establish who you are.
Does the email continue?
And instead of the move, thank you for being a patron to the start of the show, as opposed to the end, so nobody misses it.
Well, that's actually a good point. I should do that. Yeah.
This only came to my mind as you both go out of your way to be polite and gracious and are always very sincere about how much you appreciate your audience of supporters. Of course, I realize it might be difficult to switch up the rhythm of how often you open and close your multiple shows, so I understand if you choose not to take this change. We're just in a rhythm, pretty much.
A little bit. Sometimes we just... I've lost track of how many times we've started to record a podcast and I've accidentally called it the wrong name.
Yeah, it's like, which one are we doing again? Right, okay. Yeah.
It's like the stepfather. Who am I here?
On another topic, for some reason, the other day when Bibbs was apologizing for saying, I digress too much, I had an image for a t-shirt pop into my mind of a manga version of Bibbs saying, I digress. With the help of an artist on Fiverr, we whipped up such an attached image. Feel free to add it to the T Public store with my full permission.
Oh, that's so kind. But
Eric can't come to the phone right now. Please leave a message. Sincerely, Eric.
Can I see this?
Let me pull it up here. Oh, gosh.
Technology is not a good mix.
It's a zip file. I don't know from zip files. Open with... Sure, there you are. There's a manga version of you.
Oh my god, that's so cute. That is so cute. I love this. Oh my god, thank you. Oh, I love this.
I know how to put things on the TeePublic store, so I'll see what I can do about getting that on a shirt.
Send this to me. I want to use this as like my Twitter thing for a little while. That'd be amazing.
I'll forward that email.
Thank you so much. That's lovely. I really appreciate that. that means a lot to me. Thank you so much. Regarding why we introduce ourselves in front of every Patreon thing is because we want to be welcoming to new patrons. That's basically it. You have to assume that every episode could be someone's first of something. And if they're relatively new, maybe they don't really remember whose voice is which. I know when I've started listening to new podcasts, I sometimes get confused as to which host is which, unless their voices are very different. And I know Whitney and I... We have slightly different tonalities, but it's not like we have different accents or anything. We're kind of similar. So I just want to make sure everyone's clear at the outset in case you're only half paying attention or you're only just starting to notice these things. Just who's who. So I think we'll keep doing that just out of formality. But That's an excellent point about thanking the patrons up front, and we should probably do that. So, Wendy, help me remember that, okay?
Okay.
Yeah, because I that's a good point. We wouldn't be here without our patrons, and we realize not everyone can afford to be a patron, and some people have been a patron for a little while and then left for financial reasons and then come back, and that's fine, too. And sometimes people just leave because they're doing different things now, and that's fine, too, and we never want to take anyone for granted.
Yeah.
But we understand that committing to being a patron to anything for any meaningful length of time, or even just for a month, is a financial commitment that not everybody can afford, and we're incredibly grateful, and we always want to say thank you to all of our patrons who keep this show possible, because without you, it wouldn't be. Mm. We're fortunate enough now that we're starting to have some commercials, and that's cool, but that's not paying the rent. That's just that might help a little bit, yeah, you know? Like, it's not like we're rich here. Although there was a weird situation where I was listening to just quality checking a podcast we put up, and there was an ad for Halloween Kills in front of it, and that felt so official to me. Like, you didn't even like it. But, like, I was like, wow, that's a real commercial.
That's maybe a little bit of a conflict, you know. Oh. Go see Halloween Kills. Now here's a show about how you shouldn't see Halloween Kills.
I mean, I think Siskel and Ebert used to have, like, you know, movie commercials in their. I think we're not in control of that, and we're not in charge of that.
Also, I think one of the primary functions of criticism is to cut through the advertising and say what the film itself is. Ignore the era of, you know, sort of the haze of hype around a movie, cut through all of that and actually get to what's at the center of all of that. And it doesn't really matter how it was advertised at some point.
And also, it's worth noting that the commercials that play at the beginning, right now we're only putting commercials at the beginning and the end of our podcast because we don't want to be obtrusive. We don't want to, like, interrupt the flow of the conversation. But we don't actually control what commercials are going up there. So that's just kind of, it's not random because they're going off of, like, you know, what our audience is or what type of podcast we have. But again, I do want to reiterate, if you ever hear a commercial for something in front of one of our podcasts that is something that you think we would not support, please let us know, because I do believe we have veto power over that kind of stuff. And I would hate to think that there was, like, I don't know, I'm Donald Trump and I approve this message kind of bullshit. Yeah, like, man. That would haunt me to my core. Mm. So please let us know if anything like that happens. But I don't think it will. So, but yeah, that's how that works. But I digress. Damn it. I just did it. I wasn't even trying. Mm. All right. Moving on. I think we have, let's do one more.
One more letter. Okay, let me get the letters back up here.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're already done.
Here's a letter from James. Hello, James.
Okay.
Excuse me. Oh, dear. Dear Whitneyam Boldiani. Sort of like portmanteau of both of our names.
Got it.
Listening to the Iron List episode on the best horror comedies, I particularly enjoyed your segment on Happy Death Day and Happy Death Day to You, a Bibbs entry, if I recall correctly. Specifically, I wanted to offer my theory on Happy Death Day to You's reception.
Oh, okay.
Because it wasn't as big a hit as the first one.
No, bum me out. I really like that movie, too. So, yeah, what you got?
Bibbs correctly noted that the sequel is underrated and generally considered a weaker entry, and I think I know why that is. Happy Death Day to You would have been better received if it was the third entry in the franchise.
Mm.
Not saying it should have been the third, but I think people would have liked it more. Happy Death Day to You rode the coattails of its popular predecessor, and production was greenlit only 1 month after the release of the first movie.
Right.
When you get a sequel so soon, audiences want something that's largely the same, with an appropriate amount of variation. I can't think of another canonical first horror sequel that varies the formula as much as Happy Death Day to You. Mind you, Highlander 2, maybe.
That's not a horror movie, though.
That's true. Mind you, I loved it for this, but it seems people were not quite ready for that much of a shift.
Mm-hmm.
From what I can tell, fans of franchises are a lot more willing to accept massive variation by the third movie. The strongest example is Army of Darkness, but you can even bring in Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. While contemporaneous audiences were not too hot on the third Halloween film, it has since been reevaluated and found a modern audience, something I'm not too convinced will happen to Happy Death Day to You. In any case, I wondered what you thought of the idea, and if you had any other examples where a film series took a major left turn as its second film, and if it was well-received or not. Thanks, as always, James.
That's a good point, and I think that's part of it. I do think that Happy Death Day to You kind of minimized the slasher movie element of the original film and made it more about just time travel, which I think is really clever, and I think that movie works really, really well. But yeah, if that was what you glommed onto was the horror element, then you could feel a little betrayed. one, I think one of the classic examples of this is Friday the 13th, not Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge. Which, the original film, and this is only the second film in the series, but the original film was about Freddy Krueger haunting a whole bunch of teenagers and killing them in their dreams with their phobias and shit. And then the second one was all about Freddy haunting one guy and trying to take over his body. And there's a part where Freddy actually manifests in the real world. And I know a lot of people complain that, oh, they broke the rules. And I'm like, there's only one movie. The rules haven't been clearly established yet. I think two was simply firmly establishing how far the rules go. And I think as time has been exceptionally kind to that movie. That movie is actually way more sinister and way more in-depth psychologically.
Forgive me for saying this, apart from the original and the seventh, I think it's the scariest of the sequels.
I do too. I think it gets into the subconscious better.
Yeah.
Which is weird because that's literally all Freddy Krueger is. But Nightmare on Elm Street 3 through 6... not a lot of psychological complexity to those. They're pretty surfacey.
Somebody, like a character, is afraid of bugs, and in her nightmare, she turns into a bug. That's as deep as it goes.
Yeah, and that's nothing wrong with that, but it's definitely not as insidious as this storyline can get. And so I think the second film pushed that element rather than pushing the slasher formula bit. And so people, generally speaking, for many, many years were not fans of it. And then they started coming back around when Dream Warrior came around and sort of recodified the formula a little bit more. So that's definitely one. I'm trying to think if there are any other like major film franchises that took a hard left in the second one. Especially when it should get a little easier when you take out horror movies.
The original Gremlins is sort of cartoonish, but that's like a... it's sort of a send-up of Christmas movies, because it's set at Christmas time, and what would happen if monsters were loose at Christmas time?
Yeah.
And they get to sort of like shred up Santa Claus and set things on fire. And the second one is... it's just a cartoon at that point.
Yeah.
It almost like tries to undo any sort of myth that the first one set up. It is just a complete joke.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that about Gremlins 2. I think that's kind of the brilliance of Gremlins 2. Gremlins 2 is one of the best films of the 90s.
I stand by it. No, it's great. And I think you could say the same about Bride of Frankenstein as well, a movie from which Gremlins 2 takes a lot of its cues.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say. Aliens.
Oh, there you go. Aliens each Alien movie is kind of a different genre.
Yeah, but like, and this is one that people embraced. But the original Alien was very much just a straight up horror movie in space, a bunch of helpless people trapped on a ship with a monster. And then they decided to turn it into an action movie Vietnam War allegory. And it works. It's a excellent movie, but I know you're in particular not a fan of it because you thought the original was a better tone.
I think just maybe my personal taste, I like dread and death more than action schlock. And some people like action schlock better, and that's fine. That's your taste. But yeah, I vastly prefer Alien over Aliens.
I don't disagree. I happen to like both, but I think that's a perfectly valid interpretation. Yeah.
Aliens might be my fourth favorite film in that series.
That's a bold thing. Shock Treatment was a really... it's still a musical, and it's still got Brad and Janet, but otherwise it's very different from Rocky Horror. It has a much smaller cult, although it still has a cult. People do like it. I think the soundtrack is damn near impeccable in Shock Treatment. I'm trying to think of other ones that were just, like, completely switched everything around, or completely switched genres.
Didn't switch genres, but I know the premise of the second Blair Witch film, and that second Witch film was really awful.
Well, that changed genre because it wasn't a found footage film anymore.
It was still a horror movie, though, and it was still about the same things, but in the universe of the second Blair Witch film, it took place in essentially the real world, where the Blair Witch Project was a film, and they were people reacting to the Blair Witch Project as a film in the real world in the universe of Blair Witch 2. That kind of switched things up a little bit. I'm having trouble thinking of things that really did that sort of effectively.
Yeah.
And
we're a bit on the spot here. We didn't plan this out ahead of time.
Yeah, I know a lot of these films are varyingly accepted and rejected by audiences.
Bernie's too. Then they had magic. They had voodoo magic. And now Bernie, whenever music is playing, the corpse of Bernie... walks dancing towards treasure. Dances. He dances towards treasure. You know?
So they have to...
Like a thing.
They have to bring him back to life so he can... The corpse can lead them to treasure.
Yeah, and the corpse, by the way, it's been a really long time. Quartz hasn't decomposed at all. Not even slightly. The flesh hasn't even gotten a little saggy on that thing. Just it's fine.
Yeah.
Such a weird fucking film. But yeah, I'm sure if we spent more time with this, we can come up with a lot more.
And the sequelization that something warrants and deserves a sequel is very modern thinking. Yeah. You know, the idea that we can plan out an entire series of films is a relatively recent construct in Hollywood that started, I would say, with Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter in 2001, although there's probably antecedents.
There's antecedents to that, but it didn't become popularized and like the norm until like the turn of the century.
And then of course there was, and the Avengers series kind of broke it open. It's like, we're going to make an Avengers movie, but we're going to do four films first.
Like, they would occasionally plan to do two at a time. Like, they shot Superman the movie and a big chunk of Superman 2 together, but then when the budget started getting exploding, they decided to wait and finish Superman 2 later, which is why Donner got replaced by Richard Lester. Yeah. That happened.
The Donner cut's better, but I like them both.
Yeah, I'm not the biggest Superman 2 fan, but I do think the Donner cut's better.
But the pattern had been well established for many years. You make an original, it's a hit. You make a sequel that is really close to the original.
Try not to alienate people.
Oh, you know, another one that's really different is The Exorcist 2. But
there you go.
Which I hate and was not a big hit. But
Terminator 2 is interesting because structurally it's the exact same movie, but all the details are different.
The details are different,
Michael Biehn is played by Arnold Schwarzenegger.
It's a larger, slicker production as well.
Yeah, so it feels less like the first Terminator movie is basically a sci-fi slasher movie. It's about an unstoppable robot killer. The T2 is much bigger, much more action-oriented, but structurally it's incredibly similar to the point where many of the scenes have the exact same dialogue.
Yeah.
So that's one where they kind of get to have their cake and eat it too. But that one was embraced.
Yeah.
That was an R-rated horror movie that didn't make a big impact in theaters. It was only really found its audience on home video. And then when Terminator 2 came out, it was the biggest movie ever for a while.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
A huge, huge hit.
Yeah. And awesome. Really good movie. But anyway, that's all we got off the top of our heads.
Oh, but what I was going to say... I'm not done. They make a sequel and it's really similar to the original. They don't change it up too much. And it's not until you get to the third film where they've either run out of ideas, they either need to make it even bigger and bigger to the point where it's kind of absurd now, or they need like some sort of new twist to it.
Yeah.
Like they need a new character twist, or they'll change the setting, or they'll start adding magic to
it. Smokey is the bandit.
So yeah, by the time you get to the third films in series tend to be kind of weakest or strangest.
Yeah,
whether or not they're strong or weak.
That used to be the case. I don't think it's necessarily.
It's not the pattern anymore because now they're planning out movies like TV series and in each individual episode. So they don't. The pattern has been changed.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that is it for Critically Acclaimed's We've Got Mail podcast this week. Thank you. I almost said it. I managed to save it, but then I called attention to it. So there you go. Anyway, that's it for We've Got Mail this week. Thank you everybody for listening. Thank you everybody for writing in. We're sorry we didn't get to your letter. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Once again, that is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
You can send us a physical letter of Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
We're on Twitter @Critic Acclaim. I am @William Bibbiani.
I'm @Whitney Seibold.
There's other stuff that's happening, I guess.
If you sort of browse around on our Patreon, you'll get to see all of our other podcasts.
Patreon.com/Critically Acclaimed Network. We talked about a lot of those shows today, but there's even more on there. We just dropped a new episode of Only the Best, where we review every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. We're currently in the 1940s on that. And The Fish.
Coming soon for Christmas, I have another radio drama coming.
Yes, so finally!
I've written it, I have an actor who's going to record it, and I just need to get the recording and mix it together, and we're going to have a Christmas special for this Christmas. That's amazing.
COVID kind of derailed Whitney's ability to make radio dramas, but he does, if you on the Patreon, and the $20 level, you do get them for free.
Yeah.
And if you want to listen to them... anyway, you can always contact him on social media, and you can Venmo him a couple of bucks and figure it out. I forget what the rate is.
I ask for 10. If you want to buy all three, you can get them all three for 25. Yeah, just contact me on the Twitter or on, I'm also on Instagram. Yeah. You can find me. Yeah, just send me a direct message. I can Venmo you. Or you can Venmo me. I can mail it to you.
And me and my partner, M. Lopez da Silva, we have our own side hustle. We have Salt Cat Soap. It's our Etsy store. Mm-hmm. Salt Cat Soap is all one word. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter. We make and sell designer soaps that are all little art projects in and of themselves. We have some new stuff coming out for October, but until then we do have a sale going on some of our Halloween stock and some of our other nice gift-giving stock as well. So head on over to our Etsy store. You can find the link on our social media. Salt Cat Soap on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. It's all there. And thank you everybody who's already bought some soap. We've had some really wonderful reviews, and the store is pretty dang successful, actually, for a first year at Etsy. So that just means a lot to us. So thank you everybody for helping out. That is it for We've Got Mail. Thank you everybody. Hope you have a great week. Stay safe and sane. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.